20. When you come into the land, I will say, and you'll say, you want a king, you will surely set a king over thee whom the Lord thy God shall choose, one from among thy brethren. And then it says, such a king shall not multiply horses. Verse 16. Verse 17, he shall not multiply wives. He will write out a copy of the law and live out of that. He'll learn the law and live by it and that sort of thing. Kenneth says, chapter 17 could not have been written when a king was on the throne, but only when there was probability that one would be elected, and it was necessary to insist that certain things be adhered to. But someone wouldn't write a thing like Deuteronomy 17 while the king is already there. So, he says you have to get a time when there is no king, but there's a probability that one is going to be elected or selected. And interestingly enough, one of the qualifications of the king is that he must be an Israelite. Verse 15, when thou shalt set a king over thee, and the Lord thy God shall choose, one from among thy brethren shalt thou set king over thee. So may it not set a foreigner over thee, who is not thy brother. Well, when would such a situation be in existence, when there would even be the thought of setting someone as a king over the people of Israel, who might not have been an Israelite? Well, he thinks that you have to go to the post of Joel's time to find a situation that accounts for that. Of course, I think the question can immediately be raised, why not go to pre-monarchic time, shortly after the Exodus out of Egypt, when you have a mixed multitude. But in any case, here's a man in 1920 trying to push Deuteronomy instead of back toward Moses, the other direction, into the post-Israel time. And he writes a book and develops a Bible theory today. Another man, G. Holcher. H-O-L-S-C-H-E-R, 1922. Similar idea to Kenneth. He set out to prove that the book of Deuteronomy had no relationship with the law book of Josiah, but was at least 100 years after the time of Josiah. So again, we're down in the 500s. He says that to demand a single sanctuary in pre-exilic times would have been a piece of impractical idealism. Now, he's assuming that Deuteronomy demands a central sanctuary, and to do such would have been a piece of impractical idealism in pre-exilic times. He says, how could the entire population of the country journey to Jerusalem for a whole week at festival times, leaving farm animals to fend for themselves? And that sort of thing. It's very impractical to demand centralization of worship and to then place Deuteronomy chapter 12 in a pretty exilic period of time. It's just impractical. He says that Deuteronomy was not a program for reform, but the wishful thinking of unrealistic post-exilic dreamers. It was not a program for reform, but the wishful thinking of unrealistic post-exilic dreamers. This is what they'd like them to be. Not something that ever was or ever could be. So he felt that it was written sometime in the 500s, probably around 500 BC, by priests in Jerusalem, which is quite a different position from Wellhausen, because interestingly enough, Wellhausen felt there was a prophetic background in the book of Deuteronomy, not priestly, but prophetic. and that the ideas and motifs that define Deuteronomy were the result of prophetic influence, not priestly influence. So, Holscher places it in exilic time, feels it's this impractical sort of program of a priestly circle in Jerusalem, first exilic time. All right, secondly, under challenges to the classic Wellhausen position, advocates of a date earlier than 621. But later than the beginning of the monarchy. Earlier than 621, but later than the beginning of the monarchy. Or was earlier in 621, but not going back to Moses. Several names here. A. H. Ewald.
E-W-A-L-D.
H. Ewald.
Way back in 1876.
Place the origin of Deuteronomy in the reign of Manasseh. Now, Manasseh was followed by Ammon, Ammon by Josiah. So you move back, not significantly, but two kings earlier. You place the origin book in the tiny ring of Manasseh. A. Westfall.
W-E-S-T-C-H-A-L.
1910. Argued that Deuteronomy alone could inspire a reformation like that conceived and outlined by Hezekiah. Now Hezekiah was the king before Manasseh, so he moved back another king. What was behind Hezekiah's reformation? Well, Deuteronomy must have been present in the time of Hezekiah. So he placed the Argent book in the time of Hezekiah.
And then T.H. Oestreicher, O-E-S-T-R-E-I-T-H-E-R,
Theodore Oestreicher, 1923. Argued for a date earlier than Hezekiah. Perhaps as early as the 10th century, sometime in the 900s. In other words, you're getting back right to the, close to the beginning of the kingdom period. Oestreicher rejected the idea that either Josiah's reform or the book of Deuteronomy demanded centralization of worship. Now that was a basic thesis of Wellhausen. Josiah's law book and Deuteronomy demand centralization of worship. Oestreicher rejects that idea. Two terms that Oestreicher used have become rather well known in discussions around Deuteronomy. I'll give you those terms. In his view, the reform of Josiah was concerned with cult Reinheit. Now that's a German word, Kult, using just like the English word, C-U-L-T, so it's K, Kult. Reinheit is purity. So it's concerned with cultic purity. Cultic, in the sense of external, religious observance of worship. Purity of worship. Deuteronomy is concerned with Kult Reinheit. Not Kult Einheit. Now, Einheit is unity. Not cultic unity. In the sense of centralization of worship. In other words,
his view was that Josiah's reform was more concerned with purity of worship rather than unity of worship at a central sanctuary. He points out that Josiah had begun his reformation on his own initiative several years before the law book was found. So even if you conclude that that law book was Deuteronomy, which may well be the case, the finding of that law book did not initiate the reform, but gave a new impetus to a reform that had already been begun. So he sort of challenged Wellhausen's view of identifying that law book with Deuteronomy. He challenged Wellhausen's view that the book called for centralization of worship, and felt that Deuteronomy itself stemmed from a much earlier time, but that Deuteronomy did not, in any exclusive sense, demand centralization of worship. But it did emphasize purity of worship.
Does this strike you as kind of unusual that we should take as a point of argument something that the Bible actually says?
Well, I see the reason for your question, yeah, because frequently when something like that doesn't fit with the theory, then it's explained as being a later insertion or some misrepresentation, so it isn't taken seriously. I think you could say maybe the writer here is trying to take that record of Josiah's Reformation seriously, work out the implications of that, and even take Deuteronomy seriously to a certain extent, but still probably feeling that the differences between, say, the covenant code, the Deuteronomy code, and the priestly code require some kind of an explanation other than that. It's a whole mosaic. Capital D, Adam C. Welch.
A.C. Welch. W.E.L.C.H.
Two books, 1924 and 1932.
A great deal of time on Deuteronomy,
Adam C. Welch. One book was, 24 book was The Code of Deuteronomy. The 1932 book, entitled Deuteronomy, The Framework to the Code. He came pretty much independently of both writers to the same conclusion concerning centralization of worship. In other words, he did not feel that a basic thesis of Deuteronomy was to insist on centralization of worship. However, his reasoning was slightly different, coming to the same conclusion. He felt that Deuteronomy 12:1-7, which is one of the crucial passages concerning centralization, was a later insertion. So, we'll have to look at Deuteronomy 12:1-7. Eventually, to see what we think about this matter. Does it demand centralization work? Doesn't it demand centralization work? How does that relate to Wellhausen's theory? Welch says the book as a whole doesn't emphasize that. Perhaps 12:1-7 does, but that's a later insertion, wasn't original. And he felt the emphasis of the book was on the character of the places of worship, not the number. In other words, we're as opposed to this cultic purity, not cultic unity. So. He concluded that the book contains material originating in northern Israel from the time of Samuel on. So we're getting back earlier, you see, in the time of Samuel, it's pre-monarchy. It contains material that dates back that far, but that the present form that we have it in is no earlier than the 8th century BC. In other words, it goes back another century before Josiah, but no further than that. There was a period of development, process of transmission, coming into the form as we have it in now. Lastly, here are some thoughts. Done an enormous amount of work with Deuteronomy, as well as, of course, with many other areas of Old Testament study. Bunrod is one of probably the two or three most influential, I was going to say contemporary Old Testament scholars. He died just a few years ago, so he's no longer living, but a lot of his work is very recent. And certainly enormously influential. I'll mention three works of his that deal directly with Deuteronomy. First, an article entitled The Problem of the Hesychast, written in 1938. The Problem of the Hesychast, 1938. That is available in English translation in this book, The Problem of the Hesychast and Other Essays. Gerhard von Rath. The collection of articles in this book, the first and largest article is just one, The Problem of the Hesychast. Second book, Studies in Deuteronomy. Small paperback published in English translation in 1953. The German was originally published in 1948. Studies in Deuteronomy. And then a commentary to Deuteronomy. German edition 1964, English translation 1966. Deuteronomy, Gerhard von Rath. What he tried to do, which is really sort of a distinctive move out of this tradition of literary critical investigation, trying to analyze the book in a literary critical framework, was to approach the book from the form critical method. And what attracted his attention, as far as Deuteronomy is concerned, was the structure, the total structure of the book. Going way back to this Problem of the Hesychast article, 1938, page 26 and 27 in this English translation, he says this. Very interesting. We may leave aside the many difficulties currently raised by the problem of Deuteronomy, confine ourselves to a matter which has as yet scarcely been touched on by scholars, despite all the controversy about the nature of the book. What are we to say about the form of Deuteronomy, with its remarkable succession of features and laws and so on? Even if it be thought that Deuteronomy in its present guise comes straight from the theologian's desk, this does not prevent our asking what genre it belongs to. Genre, what literary form? The total structure of the book. It simply drives the question further back, compels us to look into the history and development of the form of the material used by the Deuteronomic theologians. One cannot accept the assumption that these men created ad hoc so remarkable a literary form. Now, he discusses the total structure of the book from the viewpoint of what kind of a genre is involved in this book. What is the origin of that? And what implications then does that have for state? Where does it come from? He says, one might be forgiven for imagining the Deuteronomists seated at their desk, hunting round for a diversity of forms into which they could pour a new content
and striving by the most effective combination of various elements to give expression to their special theological interests. Obviously, from the point of view of form criticism, no one would accept any such picture of the origins of Deuteronomy. It is precluded by a recognition of the fact, and this is something totally new in Deuteronomy studies, in the critical tradition up to this point, it is precluded by recognition of the fact that Deuteronomy is, in form, an organic whole. In other words, von Rad starts speaking of the unity of the book. It's an organic whole. We may distinguish any number of different strata and accretions by literary criteria. In other words, he doesn't discard this literary critical method, because there's still levels of material, earlier material, later material. But in the matter of form, the various constituents form an indivisible unity. The question is thus inescapably raised of the origin and purpose of the form of Deuteronomy, as we now have it. He then says, we've got a form that gives a unity to the book. What's the origin of the form? 1938, he says the book falls structurally into four sections. Let me give these to you and take them down. Four sections. Number one, historical presentation of the events of Sinai. Historical presentation of the events at Sinai. And paranetic material connected with these events.
Now that term he uses a lot. P-A-R-A-N-E-E-I-T.
Paranetic material connected with it. That is material that has the characteristic of exhortation, preaching, exhortion. So that's Deuteronomy 1:11. Historical summary of events at Sinai. Paranetic material connected with those events. Chapters 1-11. Two, the reading of the law.
12-26.
Through the reading of the law, 12-26. In other words, you get all the legal material in that central book, 12-26. Thirdly, the sealing of the covenant. Deuteronomy 26, verses 16 to 19. 26-16. Sealing of the covenant. And then fourthly, blessings and curses. Chapter 27 and following. So four basic sections for our structure is concerned. He says that in form the book's an organic whole. If you recognize this structure and this form, what situation in life may have produced that form? Where does it come from? What is the explanation for this remarkable form that's found in the book? He says it's not some ad hoc creation of some Deuteronomy sitting down at his desk. It's got something more to it than that. So he wants to try to press back and find some explanation for this form that he sees. In his commentary, which is much later, you see that problem of Hexus is 1938. He has this little book, Studies of Deuteronomy, in the 40s and early 50s, English translation. 64, 10 years ago, 66 in English translation. Commentary in Deuteronomy. Page 12, he says this. Deuteronomy shows a remarkable arrangement.
A predominantly hortatory speech to the people, exhortation, that's what Paranetic president did, passes in Deuteronomy 12 into a recital of the law. This part ends in Deuteronomy 26:16-19 with the formulation of the covenant. Then there follows again in elaborate detail the proclamation of blessing and curse, and that fourfold structure. This arrangement certainly cannot be explained as due to literary considerations. On the contrary, we must suppose that Deuteronomy is here following a traditional cultic pattern, probably that of the liturgy of a cultic festival. Now that is his basic idea, that the explanation for this form is to be found in a cultic liturgy that had been extant in Israel. And the form of that cultic liturgy has been adopted here in the book of Deuteronomy. So he says, bottom of page 12, we will content ourselves with the statement that Deuteronomy presents itself to us almost as a mosaic of innumerable, extremely varied pieces of traditional material. All these different kinds of material from all different kinds of times. But at the same time, this is not to deny that the book must nevertheless, in the last resort, be understood as a unity. And the unity to the book is supplied by this unique form, which we feel has its origin in some sort of a cultic liturgy. Now, von Rad then views the book as the final product of a long, complex process of development. And he regards its structure as evidence that the origins of this material are to be found in a covenant renewal festival held periodically in Shechem, in pre-monarchic time. Now, Shechem, remember, it's a town in the north of Israel, at which a covenant renewal ceremony very clearly was held and described as contained in Joshua chapter 24, at the point of the death of Joshua after Israel came into the land. There was that call of all Israel to come to Shechem, the point of Joshua's death. They renewed their allegiance to the Lord, a point of transition in leadership. Well, he felt that these covenantal traditions had their root there at that site, that sanctuary in Shechem, and that they were preserved there, and that they were passed down from early days of Israel's occupation of the land and gradually enlarged upon and ultimately we get the material from that Shechem sanctuary preserved for us in what we have presently in the book of Deuteronomy. Well, what's the intermediate link between what we have now and who preserved and elaborated on this old cultic material? And he says that in its present form, Deuteronomy is to be attributed to the Levites who preached and taught the law during the monarchical period. Now, his Levite theory, then, really, in connection with this cultic material, the way this cultic liturgy of the Shechemite sanctuary preserved and transmitted and taught by the people, is his theory for the origin of the book of Deuteronomy and the form that we presently have it. In his commentary, his conclusion as regards dates, page 26. After discussing his idea of cultic origin and his liturgy of Shechem, the transmission of this material through the preaching of the Levites, it's a long, complex process. He says, if these considerations are well-grounded, then we shall suppose one of the sanctuaries of northern Israel, Shechem or Bethel, to be Deuteronomy's place of origin, and the century before 621 must be its date. There are no sufficient reasons for going further back. Now, in other words, the century before 621, he's moved back slightly from the classic Wellhausen position as far as the final form of the book is concerned. However, he would trace the antecedents of that final form in a long process of development way back into the early days of the occupation of Canaan. Not back to Moses. Back to the early days of entrance into the land of Canaan. And connected with, primarily with the Shechem frontier. Now, I've gone into a little more detail with Von Rod because we want to come back to Von Rod later in connection with some other matters. But for the present, I think it's of interest that he does see the book as a unity. He saw this structure in the book. Along the 38 to 76. It's almost 40 years ago. But the conclusions of Zeal for the implications of that form in relation to date are basically what I told you. With the Levites being the ones responsible for putting it in its place. Yeah.
Could you give any indication
of where it's about the children? Yeah, and it's the latest commentary. That's what I want to come back to, because that's the interesting thing. He does not, I mean, just to anticipate that, he does not accept the argument of the forms in the series as completed for early dating for the But I think that's a point on which is very vulnerable since the discovery of the series. All right, thirdly, third category. That category was advocates of the date earlier than 621, but post-monarchia, in the sense that after the rise of monarchy. A third category, pre-monarchic dating, but non-Mosaic. In other words, move back further now. Pre-monarchic, before the kingship, but still not back to the Mosaic era. Two men. First, Edward Robertson.
Edward Robertson,
1950. The book, The Old Testament Problem. Edward Robertson, The Old Testament Problem, 1950. He says that the Hebrews entered Palestine possessing a nucleus of law comprising the Decalogue and perhaps the Book of the Covenant. Ten Commandments and Exodus 20 to 23. Between the settlement and the rise of the monarchy, Israel became decentralized, split up into a number of different areas and religious associations, each with their own sanctuary. There was a number of sanctuaries scattered around the land. And at those sanctuaries developed divergent, although related, traditions and laws. In other words, you get a lot of separated, sort of independent traditions developing a different sanctuary subsequent to the settlement. When the people were reunited under a king, it was necessary to bring about religious unity. You had people then from the conquest of 12 to 1400, and depending on how you date the time of the Exodus and the conquest, you had 2 to 4 centuries before kingship there. A long period of time. With the rise of kingship, there was a need for unification. So for that purpose, a summary of legislation comprising a codification of the law codes of the sanctuary was prepared under Samuel's guidance. And that code was the book of Deuteronomy. So under Samuel's guidance, all this diverse material put together in some sort of unified code. And that was to be the standard law book for the centralized administration of the kingship. Robertson would accept that Deuteronomy calls for centralization of worship and say that union of tribes under a king made centralization desirable and possible. And so he posits the arguments of Deuteronomy for this kind of process in the time of Samuel. One other man we've got to stop, R. Brinker. B-R-I-N-K-E-R. The Influence of Sanctuaries in Early Israel, 1946. Position very similar to Robertson, and dating very similar. Difference between Brinker and Robertson, he argued that centralization was not stressed. Stress is rather than centralization, it's purification and warning against syncretism with idolatry practice. Purification rather than centralization, warning against syncretism with idolatry practice. But still a date somewhere prior to monarchy, probably in the time of Samuel. Our fourth point will be a mosaic date. I'll just give you names of a few men that have maintained mosaic date all through the history of this discussion. I mean, there's never been a time without some representatives of the mosaic date also making their case in the course of this long discussion. And that brought us right up to the point of advocate for a mosaic date for Deuteronomy, which would be number four then under that heading. Mosaic date for Deuteronomy. Now, all I want to do here, rather than go into any details of lines of argumentation at this point, is mention some people who, since the time of Wellhouse, and taking into consideration all his arguments, nevertheless have maintained that there is very good reason to hold to the Mosaic origin for the book of Deuteronomy as the Bible represents the book to be. Several men. James Orr, 1906, The Problem of the Old Testament. That goes back to the early 1900s. James Orr, O-R-R, says, Problem of the Old Testament.
H.M. Wiener, W-I-E-N-E-R. 1920, in The Main Problem of Deuteronomy, the title of his study, The Main Problem of Deuteronomy, 1920.
O.T. Alice,
no doubt more familiar to you.
O.T. Alice, The Five Books of Moses, 1943.
T.J. Young, in his introduction, 1949, second edition, 1960. In Holland, a man named J. Ritterbaugh wrote a two-volume commentary on Deuteronomy in 1950 and 51, they came out. J. Ritterbaugh,
But it was a translator.
No. And also in Holland, G-C-H-Alders, A-A-L-D-E-R-S. In his introduction, also in Dutch. But that is 1953. Then more recently, one final name, R.K. Harrison. Introduction, very large work, just familiar with, 1969. I might emphasize that Harrison's introduction is a good survey of the problem of Deuteronomy. Harrison's introduction, and he comes out for its mosaic.
Or the introduction to
it. The introductory material, critical problems in state authorship, that thing. Now, of course, his book is an introduction to the Old Testament, so it treats all the books. You look in the table.
I meant under the section of Deuteronomy, or under the beginning?
No. You look under his the table of contents, and you'll see a discussion of the book of Deuteronomy. I'm not sure what the pages are. So that what I'm getting at here is that in spite of all this debate, trying to push it later, earlier, but all non-Mosaic that's going on since the time of Wellhausen, there has been a tradition very responsibly represented all the way through that has argued for the Mosaic origin of the book and defended that. Now, of course, the interesting thing is that more recently, some new lines of approach to this have developed, which, in my opinion, strongly support the traditional position that has been maintained all along as another line of argumentation to bolster that position. So that brings us then to Roman 2 in our outline. Roman 1 with authorship and date, a survey of critical approaches. Roman 2, literary structure and scope of the book and their historical implications. Roman 2, the literary structure and scope of the book and their historical implications. Capital A, the structural integrity of the book has often been questioned. Now, we've already noticed that in our discussion of the critical views of the book. The structural integrity of the book has often been questioned. Going back to Wellhausen, he found the original core being a unity, placed it late, of course, but the core, chapters 12 to 26, he thought was a unity, but what comes after chapter 26 and what precedes chapter 12, he felt were secondary additions. So the structural integrity Wellhausen, he found the original core being a unity, placed it late, of course, but the core, chapters 12 to 26, he thought was a unity, but what comes after chapter 26 and what precedes chapter 12, he felt were secondary additions. So the structural integrity of the book, from Wellhausen on, has been severely questioned. One of the problems in relation to structural integrity, we'll come back to later, but let me mention at this point, it's often been said that there are two introductions to the book. Chapters 1 to 4 being one introduction, and chapters 5 to 11 being a second introduction. G. Ernest Wright, who has the commentary on Deuteronomy in the Interpreter's Bible commentary series, you're probably familiar with that. It's a sort of a good contemporary representative of critical Bible commentary. Critical in the sense of negative criticism. Wright says of those two introductions. Neither needs the other. They seem independent of each other. In other words, he looks at the structure of the book and he says there are two introductions. They're sort of loosely connected with each other. How do you explain them? And he adopts a view of really Martin Noble. In which,
maybe it's too far astray to get into this in any detail, but Martin Noble developed a very complex idea of what he called a deuteronomic history work. What he felt was the product of some deuteronomically influenced historians of exilic or post-exilic times, in other words, very late, who wrote this deuteronomic history work, which he said ran from Deuteronomy through 2 Kings. In other words, Deuteronomy, Joshua, Judges, 1st and 2nd Samuel, 1st and 2nd Kings. You have a unit there. It's a deuteronomic history work. Now you notice what, if you adopt, no, this is Martin Noble. If you adopt Noble's view on this, he takes Deuteronomy then out of the Pentateuch. So you're left with four books. Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, and Numbers for a unit. And then the next unit within the Old Testament is this Deuteronomic history, of which Deuteronomy is not then considered part of the Pentateuch, the last of the first five books of the Bible, but the first of the second section into which the Old Testament can be divided. And adopting that as a framework, Wright as well as Noth then, say that chapters 1 to 4 of Deuteronomy introduce this history work as a whole, while chapters 5 to 11 introduce the book of Deuteronomy within that history work, plus two introductions. 1 to 4 is really the introduction to this whole block of material from Deuteronomy to 2 Kings. Chapters 5 to 11 is an introduction to the book of Deuteronomy itself, which is the first book within the larger block of material. Now that's just a sort of an illustration of another way in which the structural integrity of Deuteronomy is itself. How do you explain the organization of the book? So the structural integrity of the book has often been questioned from various directions, but that has been a question of concern. Capital B under this literary structure and scope of the book. Gerard von Rad, as we already noticed when we discussed him, called attention to the significance of Deuteronomy's structural pattern way back in 1938. Back in 1938, Gerard von Rad called attention to the significance of Deuteronomy's structural pattern. And he saw the book basically as a unit, as a whole. And he felt that there was a structure there which indicated that the book was to be taken as a unity. Now, we're going to come back to that later. We already discussed it a bit, but at this point, I think it's interesting that somebody like von Rad sees a pattern in the book that speaks of structural integrity back in 1938. Now, the reason why I say that will become clear later, I think. Capital C. Meredith Klein making use of what I think you could rightly call a form-critical approach to the book of Deuteronomy. Meredith Klein making use of a form-critical approach
to Deuteronomy. But a form-critical approach which honors the integrity of the book doesn't hypothetically construct some theory of composition which is in conflict with the statements of the book, but accepts the integrity of the book, but approaches it with this form-critical analysis, opened up a new perspective on the nature and structure of Deuteronomy. Meredith Klein, making use of a form-critical approach which honors the integrity of the book, opened up a new perspective on the nature and structure of Deuteronomy. And I think that that in turn has implications, as Klein also points out, for its interpretation and date. This structure which he finds in the book has implications both for its interpretation and for its date. Now, we have to look at Klein's thesis and try to get the essence of it without getting too bogged down in the details. You will read his Treaty of the Great King, which presents its basic idea. And what I give you here is basically what you will read, but perhaps pulling out some of the central points. First of all, Klein's thesis is that Deuteronomy is a covenant renewal document. Deuteronomy is a covenant renewal document which in its total structure exhibits the classic legal form of the suzerainty treaties of the Mosaic Age. And I'll repeat that. Deuteronomy is a covenant renewal document which in its total structure exhibits the classic legal form of the suzerainty treaties of the Mosaic Age. Now, most of you, I think, are familiar with the word suzerainty treaty among international treaties discovered in ancient times. Basically, two types: parity treaties, arrangements between equals between nations; suzerainty treaties where you have a great king and a subordinate state. The suzerainty treaty documents where you had the great king of the Hittite Empire are the ones primarily that Klein draws upon, and as they entered into a treaty relationship with subordinate smaller city-states, the structure of those treaty documents very similar to the structure of Deuteronomy. So that he says the book of Deuteronomy is a covenant renewal document. The covenant was established at Sinai. Then you have the wilderness wanderer. Deuteronomy, you come to renew the covenant, the plains of Moab. So it's a covenant renewal document which in its total structure exhibits the classic legal form of the suzerainty treaties of the Mosaic Age. Now, roughly, those Hittite treaties that Klein discusses date from about 1400 to 1200. And those of you familiar with the chronology of Old Testament history, if anyone here has had that, are aware that that is within the parameters of the Mosaic year, depending on whether you place the Exodus early or late. You're still approximately exactly that time, 1400 to 1200. Number two under Klein's basic approach, his outline of the book. Now, he has a detailed outline, but his basic outline is this: preamble, 1:1-5. Second, historical prologue, 1:6-4:49. Stipulations, 5 to 26. Curses and blessings. Or covenant ratification. Is 27 to 30. Succession arrangements. Public accountability.
Thirty-one to thirty-four.
You get those basic blocks of material in the book.
Preamble, historical prologue, stipulations, blessings and curses, succession arrangements, covenant continuity. Now,
we should perhaps, in order to get the connection and the analogy with the treaty form, know what elements are involved in the treaty form. In the treaty text, the standard elements
he has preamble here. Preamble or title. In other words, what the first section does is introduce the one who is making the treaty, the great king. Secondly, start with prologue. Thirdly, stipulation.
These are divided into two categories, basic and detail.
The stipulation. And that's important.
In the treaty, you get usually some sort of general statement that sort of sums up the obligations of the vassal toward the Caesar.
In broad general terms, the essence of the obligation, the basic obligation.
Then you get the detailed things that spell out matters of detailed
provisions in warfare and what the responsibility for the vassal is towards the Caesar in all kinds of ways.
Fourthly, you get witnesses. Especially blessings and curses.
And those are the standard elements. In some treaties, there are other elements, such as provision for deposit of a copy of the document in the sanctuary of the great king as well as the vassal, provision for periodic readings.
But the standard elements of the treaty document are those.
And of course, the general parallel becomes rather apparent. Fourthly, as far as signed treaties, Klein says that to take Deuteronomy as a covenant renewal document is not incompatible with the book's own representation of consisting of a series of addresses of Moses. To take it as a covenant renewal document is not incompatible with the representation of the book itself, that it consists in a series of addresses of Moses to the people on the plains of Moab. Klein says on page 29, Treaty of the Great King, to analyze Deuteronomy in terms of a documentary pattern is not incompatible
with the obvious fact that the book, according to its own representations, consists almost entirely of a series of addresses. For the specific kind of document in view would be orally proclaimed to the vassals at the covenant ceremony. So he takes Deuteronomy as the libretto of the covenant ceremony, sometimes including the response of the vassal, as well as the declarations of the suzerain. In other words, here you have a ceremony of covenant renewal, and Deuteronomy records what went on there. You have the address of Moses to the people, you have the response in certain instances of the vassal. So he says, when we identify Deuteronomy as a treaty text, we are also recognizing it as the ceremonial words of Moses. It's the libretto of a covenant ceremony, as he puts it. To take Deuteronomy as a covenant renewal document is not incompatible with the book's representation of stone representation of consisting of a series of addresses of Moses. In other words, you obviously find that in the book of Deuteronomy, a series of addresses. But that's not incompatible with finding this structure and of coming to the conclusion that what is happening is a renewal of the covenant in this on this occasion. Yeah.
What did you say about the ceremonial discourse that Moses had when you talked about the libretto?
Yeah, let's see. His words were this treaty document, that is Deuteronomy, was thus the libretto of the covenant ceremony, sometimes including the response of the vassal as well as the declarations of the suzerain. Now, is that what you were after or something else? Oh, when therefore we identify Deuteronomy as a treaty text, this is what you asked, we are also recognizing it as the ceremonial words of Moses. In other words, you have a ceremony involved here. And what went on in that ceremony, you have the text of that, the words that were spoken, written down and embodied in the book of Deuteronomy. Yeah.
Then would Klein feel that if this is a ceremonial reading and response, that there is another document behind Deuteronomy, which would be the actual text?
Which would be, well, the other document behind Deuteronomy would be the material that comes from Sinai, because the covenant was initially established at Sinai. And at Sinai, you, of course, get, as far as the document is concerned, primarily you get the Ten Commandments in favor of the law, but you get a lot of other legal material that was given to Moses. The pattern in Exodus is not as easily traced. But when you take Exodus 19 and Exodus 24, you have ceremony involved with the ratification and establishment of the covenant at Sinai, in which most all these elements are present. So you can find these elements back there at the establishment of the covenant. It becomes much clearer, though, as far as structure in Deuteronomy, where you come to a renewal of the relationship which previously had been established. Now, I think in all this, you have to keep in mind that you don't have any slavish copying of some Hittite treaty by Moses, but you have a pattern or form that was familiar to people in the world at that time. And it seems that when God spoke to Moses and structured his relationship to his people and entered into covenant with his people, that this was done generally in a pattern that was familiar. And there were certainly elements of what went on in establishing relationships between in the political realm between great kings and their vassals that appear, of course, on a different level and a different content, but those formal elements you find reflected in the covenant material. So that you have to allow for great latitude and difference, and I don't think that the procedure is so much to start from the Hittite treaty and try to force this pattern either on Deuteronomy or on the Exodus material. I think far more significant than this. Start with the biblical material. And you pretty soon become aware that in the covenantal sections of the Old Testament, you find certain elements constantly reappear, historical prologue, blessings and curses, those kinds of things. So you have a, what I would call a covenant form within the Old Testament that is discernible, and you can delineate it. Whether you ever even knew about this or not, leave that out. But then you have this covenant form. Then I think from that you can ask the question, well, where's the origin of this, where did it come from, what background may there be to it, and this then becomes a subject, I think, never good. But more in that direction than trying to take the form and force it on so they can do it. Yeah.
Remember what you said before about you are aware of Moses. Would it then be safe to say that if you were going to attach to this the treaty form in those days, then you would also have to say that it would give weighty evidence to the fact that this was spoken by Moses. It was something that was an oral address. Is this how treaties were done? They were spoken orally and then written down?
Well, probably both. In other words, the great king would draw up a treaty and send his representatives to come and read that to the people with whom he was concluding his treaty. So that you have the oral and the written both. Now, with Moses, we'll get into this a little bit further along. I think that you could say at Sinai, of course, he read all those laws to the people too, and it was also written. You have the oral and the written. When you come to Deuteronomy and covenant renewal, there's certain modification and updating. You're in a new situation. They've been through the wilderness now, they're going to enter the land of Canaan. Moses is going to die. And there's a transition in leadership involved. And fine focus is on that transition in leadership. We'll get to that in a minute. That's really the focal point and reason for this covenant renewal ceremony in the plains of Moab. Because Moses, so to speak, was the representative of the great king before the people. And Moses now is going to disappear. Succession becomes involved. And when succession was involved in the treaty relationship, the political way, frequently there's evidence that you updated and renewed the treaty arrangement and ceremony to make sure with the transition in leadership that there was a transition in the relationship and that everything was kept in order. So that that succession becomes an important element in this. And then you get an update and a change. Number five, just a brief notice at this point. We're going to discuss this in more detail later too. When Klein says that our point four, to take Deuteronomy as a covenant renewal document, is not incompatible with the book's own representation, series of addresses as Moses, and we speak then of Deuteronomy as the ceremonial words of Moses. Number five, then, there's a formal similarity here between Klein's approach and von Rad's approach. A formal similarity. In other words, von Rad also says that there is a ceremonial, a cultic background to the structure of Deuteronomy. And if you remember, we discussed that, and I'm going to come back to it. But von Rad sees a structure in Deuteronomy. He feels it's a unity. He says, what's the reason for it? Well, there's some ceremonial cultic background to that. The book is a reflection of a cultic ceremony of some sort. Well, Klein, in a sense, is saying the same thing. You have a covenant renewal in the plains of Moab, and the structure of addresses and flow of thought and so forth of that covenant renewal ceremony is reflected in the book of Deuteronomy, and that in turn reflects this treaty structure. There's a similarity in von Rad's and Klein's argument, however, and that's the important difference, von Rad does not honor the integrity of the book. Because von Rad hypothetically proposes that the structure of the book comes out as some sort of periodic covenant renewal ceremony held at Shechem in the Northern Kingdom, and still dates the thing later. He doesn't find any basis for Mosaic authorship in this section. Now remember, I'm talking still about Von Rod. In 1938, Von Rod sold his structure before anybody knew anything about the Hittite Treaty and the relationship between the treaty structure and Deuteronomy. Von Rod sold structure in the book because it's representative of a ceremonial cultic kind of background to the book. He then hypothetically proposed there was some sort of covenant renewal festival that was held periodically. The book relates to that. It's not Mosaic. Now, of course, Von Rod has had to, in recent years, relate his previous ideas to the new material on the Hittite Treaty. We haven't discussed that yet, but come to that.
Hadn't
Mendenhall done any work before Von Rod? No, Mendenhall's article that started all this trend was 1954. So Von Rod was 38, so 20 years later. Mendenhall's articles like that, he sort of initiated a whole area of study. But it took 10 years after 54 before it really got going. Now, like Klein's book came out in the early 60s, 63. And Klein was in pretty much in at the beginning of this discussion. Since 63, it's progressed even more, and it continues to. But you get a 20-year period of time now since Mendenhall's initial article. But that hasn't worked its way down, worked its way out, so to speak, to a tremendous extent as yet. Yeah.
How have the critics responded to Klein? Has there been a response yet?
It's usually ignored or sort of dismissed with a few comments. But I want to discuss that too, because there are a number of men, critical scholars, that worked with the treaty today and come up with different conclusions. And it's worth at least looking at how they do that and what the reason for it is. Because there are a couple of turning points in that argument that I think Klein's on the right track with. I think that the implications of that, however, are so momentous for these people schooled in this critical way of thinking that they just can't accept it. You know, the whole house would crumble. So there's a strong resistance to adopting the direction that Klein did with it, which to me, on this, you can't ever speak in terms of proof or anything like that, as far as Mosaic argument, Deuteronomy, with this kind of argumentation. But I think you can create a model that has a weight of evidence with it that speaks for itself in a certain sense when you put it over against the other models. And here's his model, here's Klein's, here's somebody else's. And I think ultimately, yeah, the integrity of the book, you're based on the claims that it makes for itself and the integrity of scripture itself. And you know, you can debate all these things back and forth. But I think that this line of argumentation has added a forceful line of argumentation to supporting the integrity of Deuteronomy as it claims to be for Moses. Yeah.
You said that this book is pretty much ignored. Does that seem to be the reception of most
evangelical books? Yeah, I'd say so. Particularly there may come a change, but presently, anything that gets a real hearing has to know soon, it seems. And when you get, there's a whole different world of thought over there. When you get over there and in those circles, anything that's written in England or America, particularly America, is almost disqualified from the start. Yeah. Some American work out, they won't even look at it. Now, of course, that's hardly fair or objective or anything of the sort, but There's a strong attitude like that. Something's going to be significant, it comes out again. And of course, I don't doubt that there's a certain amount of German national pride involved in that, but it seems to be the way it works. Yeah. That's sort of what we're up against. I guess we better stop. Klein has a very interesting comment on that. I'll get to that in the next class on the basis of the analogy which can be drawn between the suzerainty treaties of the Hittites and the book of Deuteronomy. And I had given you, I think, let's see, we've gotten down to 5 points. The fifth one being there's a certain formal similarity with Klein's idea and von Rad, in that von Rad spoke of a unity and a structure to the book with elements composing that structure roughly the same as Klein does, but von Rad hypothesizes some sort of cultic setting as the origin of the form. Klein would propose that the origin of the form comes from the Mosaic Covenant in the Mosaic era, as the Lord entered into covenant with his people at Sinai, and then for very real reason that covenant was renewed on the plains of Moab, and the book of Deuteronomy reflects that covenant renewal. Now we're going to come back to von Rad later, but for this moment just that point. Now number six. To give you just a few of the details that Klein works out, and you'll read Klein, so I need not dwell on this at great length. But number six, Deuteronomy begins, as did the ancient treaty. Page 30 in Treaty of the Great King. Klein says, Deuteronomy begins precisely as the ancient treaty began. These are the words of that expression. You have very similar expressions in the treaty document. So you have that formal similarity. Deuteronomy begins as did the ancient treaty.
Can I ask a question concerning the preamble? God really mentioned in the preamble the first 5 verses of Deuteronomy.
Yeah.
And is there... Does he have a case to
he would take
to be a great king?
Yeah, well, he would take Moses as a representative of the words of God. In other words, Moses is speaking for God, so that that becomes very clear. And in that sense, the Lord is speaking. These are the words which Moses spoke unto all Israel. Moses is the theocratic representative. And it's precisely the issue that Moses, as that theocratic representative, the representative of the great king, his leadership is going to be terminated by his approaching death, that there is need for renewal, so that the continuity of that leadership can be recognized and prepared for and perpetuated. We come to that shortly, but the question is a good question. But Moses, then, in a sense, is the representative of the great king, as he sees. Again, these similarities you cannot push to any sort of identical kind of derivation. It's using a similar form, a similar structure, adapted for quite different reasons and purposes and with quite different content. You don't want to force in some sort of artificial way the structure of the treaties on the biblical material. It's much better to treat the biblical material itself in its own integrity, but to see that there's certain relationships. Number seven, Klein's approach resolves the two introduction problems. We discussed that earlier. Various critics have, in their analysis of the book, come to the conclusion there are two introductions, and that the book is not a unity for that reason. That being one of the reasons. Also on page 30, Klein says, a major problem concerning the unity of Deuteronomy has been the presence of two introductions, chapters 1 to 4 and chapters 5 to 11. And it's often been said neither needs the other. They seem to be independent of each other. And I mentioned to you what Noakes tried to do, to make the first of those two introductions the introduction to the Deuteronomic history as a whole, running from Deuteronomy 17. The second one as an introduction to the book of Deuteronomy itself. He says on page 31, but Noakes' view and every attempt to separate Deuteronomy 1 to 4 from an original core is contradicted. The supposed problem of the two introductions is obviated, and the real structure of Deuteronomy is further clarified by these facts. An historical prologue regularly follows the preamble and precedes the stipulations in the Suzerain Decree. In Deuteronomy 1:5 to 4:49, the way Klein breaks it down, 1:5 to 4:49, qualifies admirably as such an historical prologue. So in the treatment analogy, 1:5 to 4:49, structurally corresponding to the treatment historical prologue. When covenants were renewed, the history was brought up to date. Agreeably, Moses takes up the narrative of Yahweh's previous rule over Israel at Horeb, Sinai, where the theocratic covenant was originally made. He carries the history to the present, emphasizing the most recent events, the Transjordanian conquest and their consequences. In other words, the historical prologue is updated to the point of renewal. He goes on then to say, the third division of the Suzerainty Treaty was the stipulation. Now, if you come in the treaty structure, you have the preamble, historical prologue, third is the stipulation. You remember those stipulations were divided into a basic, fundamental obligation, sort of summary, generalized, and then the specific, the details. Klein says the third division of the Suzerainty Treaty was the stipulation. And this division, Deuteronomy, can be readily identified with 5 to 26. Chapters 5 to 26. Von Rad, as noted above, included chapters 5 to 11 with 1 to 4 as a historical survey. Those two introductions. In other words, at 5 to 26, Von Rad has 5 to 11 still a historical survey. Others, separating 5 to 11 from 1 to 4, regard them as an introduction to 12 to 26. Klein's thesis then is, but Deuteronomy 5 to 11 must be recognized as expounding the covenant way of life, just as do chapters 12 to 26. Together they declare the suzerain command. The difference between Deuteronomy 5 to 11, 12 to 26 only represents differing treatments of this one theme. The former section, that is 5 to 11, presents in more general and comprehensive terms the primary demand for consecration to the Lord, both as principle and program. The latter adds the more specific ancillary requirement. Because there's also correspondence of language between Deuteronomy and the treaty. In more detailed points. And that can open up new insights into the meaning of certain words and concepts that you find in the book of Deuteronomy. The correspondence between the treaty and the book of Deuteronomy in specific word use, in certain concepts, is also an area where there's a lot of profitable study to be done.
Now, Klein points out a few things of that sort also. One illustration, page 24. The increased emphasis on the covenantal context of the law, that central element of Deuteronomy, chapter 5 to 26, the stipulation. Increased emphasis on the covenantal context of the law underscores the essential continuity in the function of law in the Old and New Testament. The covenantal concept of law. Underscores the essential continuity in the function of law in the Old and New Testament. Well, I think there's a point there that could be elaborated on greatly. But in the structure of the treaty, you have the great king who does certain beneficent things for his vassals. There's gracious acts involved. I've done this. The vassals respond out of thanksgiving, which would be one of living up to the demands of the situation. Now, it doesn't mean there aren't also certain sanctions that also reinforce that obligation. But you might say grace there precedes law in the sense of that bring it into the Deuteronomic context. God has chosen a certain people. He's redeemed that people. He's brought them out of Egypt. He's cared for them in the wilderness. Now, here are your obligations. Those obligations are to be performed out of a sense of thanksgiving and love for the great king who has done so much for them. Think of the New Testament. He loves me, keep my commandments. Okay? There are certain There is a fundamental unity in the context of the obligation to the law that we find in the Old and New Testament that is underscored by this understanding of the structure of Deuteronomy and of the nature of the Sinaitic covenant. Which leads me right into the next point. There's been an article written on the term the love of God in Deuteronomy. In the book of Deuteronomy. I think I have that listed on this bibliographic sheet here. Under Deuteronomy in the Treaty Forum, W.L. Moran, The Ancient and Background of the Love of God in Deuteronomy, in the Catholic Biblical Quarterly, 1963. D.J. McCarthy, Notes on the Love of God in Deuteronomy and the Father-Son Relationship between Yahweh and Israel. You might want to look at those articles. Very interesting articles. In this book, D.R. Hiller, Covenant, The History of a Biblical Idea, he summarizes some of that material, page 152. The love of God is a peculiar stress of Deuteronomy, and a still more remarkable instance of the book's conservation of very old covenant ideas. Now, Hiller's view is not so much for the Mosaic origin of all this material, but he finds the structure, he finds the language, and it's a lot of useful material, and you have to use it. Hiller's book critically, however. He says, love has been used in such a variety of ways in Western history that considerable scholarly effort has been devoted to discriminating the various species of affection to which the term has been applied. Deuteronomy's brand of love is an especially interesting one for two reasons. It represents a type of love very different from most recent conceptions. And it is the mother lode of much other influential biblical teaching about love for God. Love, in Deuteronomy, can be commanded. Chapter 6, verse 5. You shall love Yahweh your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your might. This means living in a relation of worship and service to the deity. Chapter 11, 1. You shall love Yahweh your God. Keep his observances, his statutes, his laws, his commandments for all time. The whole commandment, 11:22, can be summed up thus. Quote, to love Yahweh your God, to walk in all his ways, to cleave to him. 11:13, to love Yahweh is linked inseparably with to serve him. To love Yahweh is to serve him. We've heard these words so often that their doctrine does not seem surprising, but we need to remember that one theory of love, a very potent influence, has held that duty and love are incompatible. Here, they are nearly identical. And Hillard says, it is W.L. Moran, this is the article I was referring to, who has identified the language of treaties and covenants as the profane source for this conception of the love of God. Though there may be earlier examples, the first common use of love in the language of diplomacy is found in the archives of El Amarna. The relation that exists between brothers, that is, equal partners in a treaty, is love. In a treaty text, you get arrangements between brothers or equal partners. The relationship is one of, quote, love. May my brother preserve love toward me 10 times more than did his father. We will go on loving my brother fervently. From the Amarna letter. This love is not only the proper feeling between equal partners, however, but it is the way that Pharaoh regards his vassals. Also from the Amarna letter, if the king, my lord, loves his faithful servant, let him send back the 3 men. Now that's from some vassal. If the king, my lord, loves his faithful servant, let him send back the 3 men. Above all, it's the way vassals are to consider their lord. To love is equal to being a servant. My lord, quote, just as I love the king, my lord, so do the king of Nuhasi, the king of Nui, all these kings are servants of my lord. In the Esarhaddon Treaty, love is commanded as a duty toward the suzerain. You will love Ashurbanipal as yourself. What I won't go through a lot of the rest of the material, you can read the article, but what it boils down to is this, that love in the treaty text becomes synonymous with obedience. When you love the Lord, you obey the stipulation. So that love can be commanded then. You are to love the Lord. You are to obey the stipulation. You said love is demonstrated in that. So that there are many illustrations of that sort of thing where you find similar use of words in treaty documents that gives you some insight into a lot of the biblical material. Now again, you don't want to read all the biblical material under the total control of extra-biblical material. But extra-biblical material as far as thought, form, that sort of thing that were extant in the time in which those documents originated can help you understand connotations of meaning that you find in the biblical material. And there are many similarities in language and in concepts and specific points that can be pointed to in treaty text and found also in Deuteronomy. Now, we'll notice some more of that as we progress during the course. That's another area where there is a great deal of work that has been done already and a great deal more work which can be done. I'd like to move on now to a new heading. Capital C, just to review, to get your continuity. Meredith Klein, making use of a form-critical approach which honors the integrity of the Scripture, has opened this new perspective on the nature and structure of Deuteronomy, which in turn has implications for its interpretation and date. That was C. Klein's whole thesis opened up a new perspective, has implications for interpretation and date. We looked at what that basic thesis was. Let's see. the fundamental ideas of it are, now, capital B. The covenant form in the Old Testament and its historical implications. The covenant form in the Old Testament and its historical implications. Dash, the present state of affairs in the Deuteronomy debate. The covenant form in the Old Testament and its historical implications. Dash, the present state of affairs in the Deuteronomy debate. Number one under D. I'll use this term because it's technical term that certainly applies here. Number one, the Tiptin Laban of the covenant form. Historical implications of its presence. The Tiptin Laban, a situation in life of the covenant form, and the historical implications of its presence. The situation in life of the covenant form, the historical implications of its presence. There's widespread agreement, pretty much across the board, that the covenant form is a discernible and important literary feature of the Old Testament. Now that's something that's developed in the last 10 to 15 years. But there's general agreement that there is such a thing, that it's discernible, that it's present in the Old Testament. Can be found in, with more debate, but it can be found in Exodus 19:24, Sinai. It's almost universal agreement, it's found in Deuteronomy. With about as much agreement, it's found in Joshua 24. And numerous other passages, won't list all of them. But there is this widespread agreement of the existence of what you could call a covenant form, and that it's an important literary feature of the Old Testament. There is, however, no corresponding agreement on the origin of this phenomenon. Where did it come from? There's no corresponding agreement on the question of the origin of this phenomenon, and therefore, and the historical implications which may or may not be drawn from its admitted presence. It's admitted that it's there, but there's no corresponding agreement on the origin of the form, and therefore on the historical implications which may be drawn from the presence of the form. Pardon? And in some, yeah.
Just to get this, the fourth time it was in most camps that the form does exist, but there isn't a unity of fourth times in where it came from.
Where it came from, or those stark implications then it can be drawn from. In some circles, there's expressed resistance to attempts which have been made by, for example, Klein and others, to draw historical conclusions from the fact of the presence of the form. There's been resistance to the attempt to draw historical conclusions from the fact that the form does exist. Admit it exists. But then, you know, what are you going to do with it? What conclusions are you going to draw from that? Well, right at that point, some have begun to resist drawing historical conclusions from the admitted presence of the form. For example, and it's not so important that you take these examples all down, but I just want to give you an idea here of this particular tradition. There is a book called The Covenant Formulary, by Klaus Balzer, B-A-L-T-Z, A-R-E-R. The Covenant Formulary by Klaus Balzer. It it's a book which traces the occurrence of this covenant form throughout the Old Testament. It speaks passage after passage after passage, forms the form there. On down into the Dead Sea Scrolls here. In that book, page 7, note 49, commenting on the original article by Mendenhall. Mendenhall, you remember, is the one who initiated this whole discussion. His article on law and covenant and Israel and the ancient Near East. And drew the analogy. It's like treaty, covenant, form, and similar. Mendenhall started the whole thing. Also, commenting on Mendenhall's article says of Mendenhall, he's more interested in historical questions. While the present work limits itself to the form critical approach, no doubt further conclusions, not least in the historical sphere, can be drawn on the basis of this beginning. But I consider it methodologically dangerous to bring both sets of questions together prematurely. And he resists moving toward historical conclusions to be drawn from the present to the form. A Roman Catholic scholar reviewing Balzer's work, The Covenant Formulary, says Balzer insists throughout on a sharp separation between the form critical investigation and the historicity of the episodes narrated. This reserve toward matters historical, which still lies far short of skepticism, owes its vigor to the influence of Altmos and von Raab. In this way, Balzer has successfully avoided hasty and premature conclusions. An author has the right to delimit its scope and material, but it's disappointing that Balzer eschews historical conclusions. Balzer, you see, is not willing to start going the direction of fine and drawing these historical conclusions in relation to argument of the form and its mosaic setting, that sort of thing. D.J. McCarthy, I'll just read you this, you need not get the documentation for it. An article on Biblica, reviewing a German book on this general subject, says of the treaty covenant analogy, quote, "No doubt too much has been claimed for the analogy, and especially illegitimate historical conclusions have been drawn from it." Now, he doesn't say who he's talking about. He says, still, this does not invalidate such evidence as there is for the analogy. The analogy is there, but don't draw too hasty or illegitimate historical conclusions then. So, the point I wanted to make at this point is that this resistance has arisen to withdrawing the historical conclusions from the admitted presence of the literary form. Now, I think a word is in order at this point. Certainly, caution should be used in use of the form critical method to draw historical conclusions, because it's precisely in this area that there's been such wild theories proposed for the origins of certain forms. And there's an enormous amount of subjectivity that can become involved in that whole process. So there's a caution in order there. However, the presence of a certain form, on the other hand, presupposes a historical setting which has given rise to the form in question. If you have a literary form of a particular definable type, that form presupposes a historical setting which is giving rise to the form in question. You have a telegram, you know where that comes from. You have an advertising sheet that is a certain context in which that kind of literature is utilized and out of which it rises. So literary forms do presuppose certain kinds of historical settings. And insight into the reason for and significance of the utilization of the form can be gotten by determining the historical setting which gave rise to it. So that a judicious attempt to delineate the historical setting for a particular form can be a useful interpretive tool. And I think in the case of the covenant form, you have a form in the Old Testament. The question of when and how it was adopted in Israel and matters of fundamental significance. And if you avoid that question of when and how it was adopted in Israel, you impoverish the study of the form. You can even go into perhaps misinterpretations of the significance of the form if you don't understand where it came from, what its original study was. So that caution is ordered, in order. Certainly there is also a great deal of significance to be attached to this question, what was the purpose of, and the time of, the original adoption of this form in Israelite usage.
Yeah. I'm wondering, how much of a correspondence is there between the form critical idea, say, that Klein uses, and that of the traditional form criticism? I get the impression, say, from Dunkel, that the form goes back not necessarily to a concrete situation that happened, which gave rise to the form, but more of a tradition type of thing. A band of roving poets that go around telling stories that develop into a document or something like that.
Yeah, well, I'd say in many instances, and what you're saying is one, I think, in many instances, the definition of the situation note, the Christian work, Christian noting that gave rise to particular form is purely and totally hypothetical. And really, the creation of the genius or imagination or whatever of the particular critic who was saying there's a form and it originated here with no evidence that it originated here. You know, he creates that situation in order to explain the form. An awful lot of that goes on, and it becomes very subjective. And based on frequently little or no evidence, and purely hypothetical. And I think you have to be very leery of that and stay away from that kind of utilization of a form critical method. But on the other hand, it seems to me that the legitimate use of a form critical method illustrates case in point where you have a covenant form. Where does that form come from? What's the explanation of the origin of it? What situation in life is the most likely explanation for its adoption? And when in Israel's history would there be a situation that would give rise to a form that has such enormous influence in the whole subsequent history of the nation, forms of worship, means of expression, the whole thing, you know? It seems to me that, you know, there's a lot of evidence then to point back to the Bible by itself, to the event of Sinai being the situation in life, which gave rise to the form. Under this question then, one, fixed in waving of the covenant form, historical implications of its presence, small a. The nature of the covenant form and its origin. The nature of the covenant form and its origin. And then dash cultic question mark or historical. Cultic or historical. The nature of the covenant form and its origin. Cultic or historical. And I'm going to have to hold a discussion just to go find it. That becomes a significant question, particularly in today's debate, and particularly as concerns by not. If he recognizes the form, he will posit some sort of cultic origin. You can't totally separate cultic and historical, but in von Rad's framework, I think the politics way gets to the point of what's being done. Pick up there on Monday.